By this time, Robin could speak enough of the language to find out from Karanga more about the great wizard, from whom the chief had received the magical porcelain talisman, and the story filled her with excitement and anticipation. Many rainy seasons ago, old Karanga was not sure how many. At his age, every season blurred into one before or the one after. Anyway, at some not too far distant date, an extraordinary man had come out of the forest, even as she had come, and like her, he had been fair-skinned. However, his hair and beard were the colour of flames, he showed her the campfire. And he was without doubt a magician and prophet and rainmaker. For the day he arrived, the long drought had broken with thunderous storms that filled the rivers for the first time in many years. The pale wizard had performed other rare and wonderful feats, transforming himself first into a lion and then into an eagle, raising the dead from the grave and directing the lightning with a wave of his hand. The tale had lost nothing in the retelling, Robin noted wryly. "Did anybody speak to him?" Robin asked.
"We were all too afraid,"
Karanga admitted, shaking theatrically with terror.
"But I myself saw the wizard as an eagle fly over village and drop the talisman from the sky."
He flapped his skinny old arms in pantomime. The strong anchovy smell would have attracted the bird to the discarded pot, Robin reflected. But when it proved inedible, the bird would have dropped it, by chance over Karanga's village.
"The wizard stayed a short time near our village and then went away to the south. We have heard that he travelled swiftly, obviously in his guise as a lion. We heard of his miracles, the word shouted from hilltop to hilltop or tapped out by the drums, how he cured others sick to death, how he challenged the ancestral spirits of the Karanga in their most sacred places, shouting abuse at them to all who heard him, and they all trembled. We heard also how he slew the high priestess of the dead, an Amlimo of vast power in her own stronghold. This strange pale magician slew her and destroyed her sacred relics."
In fact, he had raged through the land like a man-eating lion, which of course he was, until finally he came to rest upon a dark hilltop far to the south, the Mountain of Iron, Dabazimbi, where he stayed to perform diverse curses and miracles, so that the people came to him from far and wide to buy his services with corn and other offerings. "Is he still there?" Robin demanded. Old Karanga rolled his watery eyes and shrugged.
"It is always difficult and dangerous to predict the comings and goings of wizards and magicians,"
that eloquent gesture seemed to say. The journey was not so straightforward as Robin had hoped, for the further he went from his own village, the less certain old Karanga became of his direction, or of the exact location of the Iron Mountain, which he had told her of. At the beginning of each day's march, he informed Robin confidently that they would reach their destination that day, and as they went into camp each evening, he told her, apologetically, that it would be the next day for certain. Twice he pointed out rocky kopjes.
"That is indeed the Iron Mountain,"
but each time they were driven off with a hail of boulders and throwing spears from the heights.
"I was mistaken," Karanga mumbled. "There is a darkness in my eyes sometimes, even under the noonday sun."
"Have you verily and truly seen this mountain?" Robin demanded sternly, almost at the end of her patience, and Karanga hung his silver-wrinkled head and with great industry picked at his nostrils with a bony finger to hide his discomfiture.
"It is true that I have not personally seen this place, not with my own eyes, but I have been told by one who spoke with a man who he himself," he admitted.
And Robin was so angry that she shouted at him in English, "You naughty old devil! Why did you not say so before?" Old Karanga understood the tone, if not the words, and his misery was so apparent that she could not sustain her anger for more than an hour. His gratitude, when she once more allowed him to carry her water bottle and food bag, was pathetic to see. Robin was now consumed with impatience. She had no way of knowing how far behind her was Zuga and his hunting party. He might have returned to the camp at Mount Hamden, and found her note the very day after her departure, or he might still be killing Elephant 100 miles away, completely unaware that she had marched without him. Her disapproval of her brother, and her anger at his recent actions, had gradually evoked a sense of competition in her. She had come so far and accomplished so much on her own, from the contact with the Karanga village to following the traces of her father so far and so doggedly, that she fiercely resented the idea of his arrival when she was at the very point of making the prayed-for and long-delayed reunion with Fuller Ballantyne. She guessed how the tale would be told in Zuga's journal, and in the book that would follow it. She knew who would get all the credit for the arduous search and its brilliantly successful conclusion. Once she had thought that fame and praise meant little to her, she believed she would be content to leave that to her brother. She had believed that her own reward would be her father's embrace, and the deep personal knowledge that she had brought some comfort or some surcease to the suffering black peoples of her Africa. "I still do not know myself all that well," she admitted, as she called the third successive Tirikeza, double-marching her porters relentlessly to keep ahead of Zuga wherever he might be. "I want to find Pater, I want to find him alone, and I want the world to know I found him. Pride is sinful, but then I have always been a sinner. Forgive me, sweet Jesus. I will make it up in 1,000 other ways. Only forgive me this one small, unimportant sin," she prayed in her rude grass shelter, and as she did so she listened with one ear for the shouts of Zuga's bearers coming into camp, and her heart tripped at each sudden noise. She was tempted to break camp and call a night march towards the next distant hill they had seen on the horizon at sunset, and which old Karanga had once again confidently declared to be the Iron Mountain. The moon was full and would rise in an hour. That one march might be all that was necessary to keep ahead of her brother. However, her porters were exhausted. Even Juba was complaining of thorns in her feet. It seemed that only she and old Karanga were able to maintain this pace for day after day. She must let them rest. The next morning she had them away when the grass was still bent under the weight of dewdrops, and before she had gone a mile her breeches were soaked to the thighs. During the last few days' march the character of the land had altered. The elevated plateau of rolling grassland and open forest across which they had marched so long now seemed to be dipping southwards, and the single peak which she had seen the night before slowly evolved into a whole series of hills stretching across her horizon from west to east, and she felt her spirits sag. What chance would she ever have of finding one man's camp, one single hilltop, against so many? But she slogged on doggedly, and she and Karanga reached the first foothills before noon, well ahead of the column. She checked Zuga's barometer, nestling in its velvet-lined wooden case, and found that the altitude was still well over 1,200 feet, though they had dropped 200 feet in the last 2 days' march. Then, followed closely by Karanga, and at a little distance by Juba, she climbed the rocky shoulder of one of the foothills, and from its height had a clearer view ahead over the confused and broken ground. She could see that the hills descended sharply into the south. Perhaps they had crossed the highlands, and before them lay the descent to one of the known rivers that Tom Harkness had marked upon his map. She tried to remember the names, Shashi and Tati and Maklutsi. Suddenly she was starting to feel very lonely and uncertain again. The land was so vast. She felt like a tiny insect pinned to an endless plain beneath the high, pitiless blue sky. She turned and looked back into the north, using the long, brass-bound telescope to search for any signs of Zuga's party. She was not certain if she was relieved or disappointed to find none. "Karanga!" she called, and he scrambled to his feet readily and looked up at her on the pinnacle of rock on which she stood. His expression was trusting as that of a pet dog. "Which way now?" she demanded. And he dropped his eyes and stood on one bird-thin leg, scratching his calf with the other foot as he pondered the question. Then, with an apologetic gesture, he indicated the nearest half-dozen promontories along the skyline ahead with a hesitant, all-embracing gesture. And Robin felt her heart sink further. She had to admit at last that she was lost. She knew then that she would have to do one of two things. Either camp where she was until Zuga came up, or turn back along her own spoor until she met him. Neither alternative was attractive, and she put off the decision until the morrow. There was water in the riverbed below her, the usual shallow, warm, green pools, foul with bird and animal droppings. Suddenly she felt very tired. While the expectations of success had buoyed her up, she had not noticed it, but now she felt deflated, and the marrow of her bones ached with weariness. "We will camp here," she told the corporal. "Take two men and find meat." They had marched so long and hard since leaving Kuranga's village that there had been no time to hunt. By this time the last of the dried buffalo meat smelt like badly cured hides and was full of bacon beetles. She could only eat it in a strong curry, and the curry powder was almost finished. They needed fresh meat desperately, but she was too dispirited to lead the hunting party. The porters had not finished thatching the low lean-to roof that would be her home for the night when she heard a fusillade of musket fire close by in the forest, and an hour later Corporal came into the camp. They had found a large herd of the lovely sable antelope, harrisbuck as Zuga insisted on calling them, and had succeeded in bringing down five fat chocolate-coloured cows. The porters, chattering happily, left en masse to help bring in the meat, and Robin wandered listlessly down the riverbed, accompanied only by Juba, until she found a secluded pool. "I must smell as good as old Kuranga," she thought, scrubbing herself with handfuls of white sand, for she had weeks previously used the last of her soap. She washed out her clothing and spread it to dry on the smooth, water-worn rocks around the pool. Then, still naked, she sat in the sunlight, and Juba knelt behind her and combed out her hair so that it could dry. Juba was obviously pleased to have Robin to herself again, without old Kuranga hovering nearby, even though Robin was silent and dejected. Juba loved to play with her hair, and delighted in the reddish lights that flared in the sunlight as the comb stroked through it. She chatted merrily as she worked and gurgled with laughter at her own sallies, so that neither of them heard the footsteps in the sand. And it was only when the shadow fell at Robin's feet that she realized that they were not alone. With a cry of alarm, she rose, snatching up her still wet breeches and holding them to her breast to cover her nudity. The woman who stood before her was unarmed, nervous as she was, and shy. Not a young woman, though her skin was smooth and unlined, and she had all her teeth still. She was almost certainly Mashona, with the finer, more Egyptian features than the Nguni, and she wore the short kilt that left her upper body bare. Her naked breasts were large, out of proportion to the slim, upright body. The nipples were raised and drawn out, as though she had recently been nursing an infant. "I heard the guns," she whispered shyly, and Robin felt a lift of relief when she understood the language. It was Kuranga. "I came when I heard the guns. I came to lead you to Manali." Robin felt the quick rush of tears scald her eyes at the name, and the leap of her heart made her gasp aloud. Manali! The man who wears a red shirt. Her father had always stoutly maintained that the colour red discouraged tsetse fly and other stinging insects, and that good thick flannel staved off the ague of fever. Robin jumped to her feet, completely oblivious now of her nudity, and rushed to the woman, seizing her arm and shaking it. "Manali!" she cried, and then in English, "Where is he? Oh, take me to him, this instant!"